It's half past eight.
It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike sets up a panel of four experts willing and able to take on all questions. For every question used, Lucky Strike will reward you with $10 in defense stamps. If the question is muffed, you get a total of a $50 defense bond plus the 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid, and all questions become the property of Information, Please. Now light up a lucky strike as I present our Master of Ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information, Please continues as before, a completely impromptu and spontaneous program. Tonight, our massive intellect consists of our two regulars, Franklin P. Adams and John Kieran, and to make up the quartet, we introduce our old friend Jan Struther, creator of Mrs. Miniver, and one of the world's great biologists, a worthy bearer of a great name, Julian Huxley. I might mention, by the way, that over in London they have an Information, Please, too, which they call the Brain Trust. And it's true, Mr. Huxley, that you're one of the regular members of the Brain Trust.
That's right.
Do you see any difference between the way in which we run our Brain Trust and the way in which you run yours over there so far?
Well, I gather that we do more discussion and you have more straight questions.
Well, we'll see. We may give you a chance to do some discussion before the evening is very much older. We'll begin, Mr. Huxley, with a rather funereal question, if that's all right with you, coming to us from Mrs. Joseph M. Bryan of Everglades, Florida. From your knowledge of familiar songs, tell me who rested in the following ways. Who rested in the old churchyard? In the old churchyard. This is a burial question. Mr. Kieran.
The old churchyard in a corner, something in a lone Sweet Alice lies under the stone.
That's correct, yes. Very good. And who was being informed of that fact in the old song?
Ben Bolt.
Ben Bolt, yes. In the old churchyard in the valley, Ben Bolt.
By Thomas Dunn English.
By Thomas Dunn English is right. How about someone who rested over the sea in an old song to Miss Struther?
My Bonnie.
My Bonnie, yes. And who rested by thy murmuring stream? By thy murmuring stream. Mr. Kieran.
My Mary.
My Mary, yes. Can you give us a
sweet by thy flow gently, sweet afton, among thy green braes.
Yes. Now, Mr. Huxley, how would you discuss a thing like that? You see? I'm afraid we're much more simple over here than you are over there. Finally, who rested in the billowy wave? In the billowy wave. Mr. Adams.
Kit Willow.
Yes. First name? Tom. Oh, wasn't it Tom Tit?
A little Tom Tit.
Yes. First name Tom, last name Tit Willow. Quite right. What is the line that would give us his final resting place? Can you remember it?
And something in the gurgle he gave, and he flung himself into the billowy wave.
Yes, that's approximately it. Plunged himself into the billowy wave, and an echo arose from
the suicide's grave.
And so,
tick-willow.
Yes, that was Mr. Adams' solo. Here's one from Frank L. Martin of Arlington, Virginia. Now, let us suppose that three male admirers are courting their girls, and these girls are all girls in the animal kingdom. They are not human. The first one waved a large claw in the air. The second offered a package of food as part of his courting. And the third showed his intended building material. Who in each case would be doing the courting? Mr. Huxley.
First would be a fiddler crab.
What would he be doing again?
He'd be waving his large colored claw in the air.
Yes.
One large one and one small one.
He keeps the small one hidden?
He keeps the small one to eat with. The female has two small ones.
And no large one?
No large one.
And what does the female fiddler crab do when she sees this large claw being waved at her? Does she wave back?
No. She keeps it to herself, but sometimes she gives in.
You've apparently watched this sort of thing going on in the course of your career. Now, the fiddler crab is right. What's the female of the fiddler crab called, by the way? Is there
Oh, she called a fiddler crab, too?
That's right.
Very good. Now, how about the second, who offered a package of food?
That would be an impid fly.
I beg pardon?
That would be a fly of the family Impidae.
Would be offering what?
Offering a packet of... He'd offer another insect wrapped up in a silken cocoon to his mate.
An insect smaller than himself. Must be a very, very tiny one. And would the spider also offer food to his mate? Intended mate, shall we say?
Not generally, no.
Well, I don't, over here on this white card, it says that the spider does do that. I don't know. It says that the spider often carries a fly in a highly edible condition around to attract his...
He may do it sometimes, but the impid flies do it regularly.
Ah, you have me there, Mr. Huxley. I bet that's true. Little impid flies. All right. Now, what the third would be showing building material to his sweetheart.
Well, quite a lot of birds do that. Penguins do that.
Penguins?
Yeah.
They do? What sort of building material do they offer?
Stones.
Really? That's a fine thing to offer. Yeah. Stones.
And there was a man who studied the penguins in the Antarctic, and the penguins, they don't always restrict themselves to their mates. When anything interesting strikes them, they go and offer stones to them. And he said he was so embarrassed the first time a male penguin offered him a stone.
Well, are these penguins who don't make any distinction, are they the more intelligent or the less intelligent penguins who offer these stones variously?
I think average intelligence.
Average intelligence. Well, that, very good, Mr. Huxley, on that. I see that you've spent your life to some advantage. Here's one from Mrs. M.C. Bowler of Minneapolis. I'm going to test your knowledge of some quotations. Who, according to a familiar quotation, was all tears. That's all I'm going to give you in the way of a hint. Does it ring a bell? Mr. Huxley.
Niobe.
Very good, yes. It's what's the source of the quotation? However, the answer is correct. Niobe. It's from the first soliloquy of Hamlet. He's describing his mother. Remember that, Mr. Kieran?
Yes, that's
right. A little month or ere those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father's body, like Niobe, all tears. That's very good, Mr. Huxley, getting that. That's not too well known. Now, who, according to a familiar quotation, was all mimsy, M-I-M-S-Y, Miss Strother.
The Borogoves.
Ah, yes, the Borogoves. Mr. Huxley?
The Borogoves.
Borogoves.
Borogoves. You shouldn't put in your R that way. All mimsy were the Borogoves, and the mome raths are the grave, of course, and that means Miss Strother.
Pass it.
You, this is your chance to tell everybody what the line means. No one ever has discovered what it does mean. Who was all for one?
What's that?
Who were all for one? Mr. Adams.
Equity.
A very true and very good answer. Mr. Sharon, is there another?
Athos, Porthos, Aramis, and D'Artagnan.
Yes, the three musketeers, all for one and one for all. It is the motto of equity, though, isn't it, Mr. Adams? Never,
so I've heard.
Never occurred to me. Very good. And finally, who was all forlorn? All forlorn. Mr. Huxley?
The milkmaid.
Yes, that's correct. This is the maiden, all forlorn, who milked the cow with the crumpled horn. Do you have any... Do you know why she was all forlorn, Mr. Huxley? Do you have any idea? Did it come to mind at all? And this is one of those things you might want to discuss.
Because it rhymes with horn.
Because it rhymes with horn. Yes, discussion is very primitive over here. Nathan Fine of Brooklyn sends this one in. I think we ought to get all on this. What national organizations are now using these catch sentences on their advertising posters? These are slogans. Defend tomorrow, today. Defend tomorrow, today. Who's using that slogan? A very good one, and a very good organization that uses it, to wit, the Boy Scouts of America. The Boy Scouts of America, Mr. Brother and gentlemen, that's one wrong. Here's another. If you can't go, give. If you can't go, give. Mr. Adams.
Sounds like the USO.
No, it would be very appropriate.
Red Cross.
The Red Cross is right, Mr. Adams. Yes, the American Red Cross War Fund particularly is using that slogan now. You buy 'em, we'll fly 'em. You buy 'em, we'll fly 'em.
That's the defense bonds.
Yes, for the government defense bonds and stamps. Well, that sends one defense bond, a $50 one, to Mr. Fine, plus a set of the Britannica. And sends us on to this question from Daniel M. Kelleher, Jr. of Winthrop, Massachusetts. Who are these military men? They're all fictional characters. The first is, we'll begin with a private, Private Terence Mulvaney. Private, oh, we have four hands on that. Miss Trevor?
The character out of Kipling's stories about the three privates in the British Army.
Yes, and what are those stories called? The whole collection.
Soldiers Three.
Yes, and who are the other two?
Leroyd.
Very good.
And...
Mr. Kieran?
Stanley Arthurus.
Yes, Leroyd comes from what county, Miss Trevor?
Yorkshire.
Yes, and Arthurus? Mr. Huxley from London. Yes, yes, he's a cockney. Major Dobbin. Major Dobbin, Mr. Kieran.
Major Dobbin is the faithful friend in Vanity Fair.
Yes. Very good. Major General Stanley. Major General Stanley, Mr. Adams.
Major General Stanley is the man that sings a patter song in the Pirates of Penzance.
Very good. That's quite right. And Captain Gooding. Captain Gooding, G-O-O-D-I-N-G, Mr. Adams.
Captain Gooding is the boy that was spoken to in the... perhaps in the first stanza of Yankee Doodle.
Yes, I don't know whether it's the first or not, but it's
certainly
one that most of us don't know.
To the front.
That's right. Father and I went down to camp along with Captain Gooding, and there we see the men and boys as thick as hasty pudding. I don't think most of us remember that verse, Mr. Adams. I think it's very clever of you.
They do in my set.
It may be so. Edith Sarenson of Van Ness, New York, sends this one in. Get 3 out of 4. And it's going to be a musical question, Mr. Other and gentlemen. And each of these compositions that you hear played, there are going to be 4 of them in all, should suggest some scientific occupation. let's see if they do. Mr. Kahn, let's have the first. Mr. Kieran.
A geologist.
Yes, why?
Rock of Ages.
Yes, very good. Rock of Ages, Cleft for Me, and so forth. Did that not occur to any of you other brilliant wits, Mr. Adams? It did?
Yes.
You just didn't want to say. I know how it is. Very well, let's have the second. Mr. Adams, you seem affronted.
Don't know what the tune is.
You don't know what that tune is?
No.
Oh, a very familiar tune, Miss Trevor.
I know the tune, but I don't know what it suggests. La Cucaracha.
Yes, doesn't it suggest any kind of scientific occupation to you, Mr. Kieran?
An entomologist.
Yes, an entomologist.
Yes.
Of course.
Oh.
La Cucaracha, Mr. Huxley, this is more or less in your line.
Z. Cockroach.
Yes, Z. Cockroach. It's part of the province of an entomologist, isn't it, to know something about cockroaches? Not only entomologists. Very well, now the third. Shouldn't be surprised if we needed Mr. Levant here this evening on this one.
He wouldn't know that.
He wouldn't know that? You mean that's too familiar, Mr. Adams? Well,
I don't know.
Does it come to you, Mr. Kieran?
I don't know what the song is.
Well, it's Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre.
Oh.
Well, that would recall what sort of scientist, Mr.
Undertaker.
Well, yes, an undertaker, hardly a scientific occupation.
Anthropologist.
Yes, or an anatomist, let's say, having to do with skeletons. Well, that gives us one wrong. We have to get the next one right. Go ahead. Why do you say that?
The flat foot floozy with the toy claw.
Very good, and I congratulate you on your mastery of our language, Miss Trevor. Well, now, so far, Lucky Strike has paid out just one $50 defense bond, and that means one set of the Britannica. Now, Mr. Cross, always a believer in order and logic, reminds us of the importance of putting first things first.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, in choosing a cigarette, it's our first importance to make sure of fine tobacco. For clearly in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. That's why year after year at tobacco markets below the Mason-Dixon line, the makers of Lucky's consistently pay the price to get the milder, better-tasting leaf. For example, at auctions in Tabor City, North Carolina, season of 1939, the American Tobacco Company paid 30% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 30% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And that crop, properly aged, mellowed, and blended with other fine crops, is in the Lucky's you buy today. No wonder that with independent experts, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. Mr. Fadiman, have I shown that it's worthwhile to smoke the smoke tobacco experts smoke?
Mr. Cross, you've rendered a very complete accounting of the reasons and in only 58 seconds. Now, Mr. Struther and gentlemen, we'll go on with the second half of the program. Here's one from Hollywood, California, from Bernice Cornell. It's about famous ifs in poetry. Let's get 3 out of 4. I guess Mr. Roosevelt would call this an iffy question. It's full of ifs. If it were done. If it were done, Mr. Kieran.
If it were done, when twere done, then twere well that twere done quickly. Hamlet.
Macbeth. Very good. What is Macbeth thinking about?
He has a little matter of murder on his mind.
That's right. Which he disposes of pretty quickly. That's a very famous sentence in a famous speech. Now, here's another if. If all the land were apple pie...
And all the something were...
Ah, you all do remember that. Can you go on with it, Mr. Other and gentlemen?
What should you do?
Yes, a little ragged. And all the trees were bread and cheese. What should we have for a drink? Who wrote it, Mr. Adams?
Anon.
Anon is right this time. Here's another if. If love were what the rose is. Oh, we have 3 hands on that. Mr. Adams.
Swinburne.
Swinburne is right. How does it go on? Do you remember the rest of the if?
There are several stanzas and they all begin with if. If you were April's lady and I were Lord of May is another one.
That's
love were like the roses.
That's the one.
And I were like the leaf.
That's good. Our lives would grow together in sad or singing weather and so forth. And what's the poem called, Mr.
Swinburne?
A match. Very good. By Swinburne. Here's another if. And if sometimes our conduct isn't all your fancy paints, Mr. Kieran.
Single men in something barracks don't grow into plaster saints by Rudyard Kipling.
Yes, the poem called?
That's, Tommy Atkins.
Tommy Atkins, yes. Very good, Mr. Kieran. Well, that gives us all 4 riffs out of 4. You're doing very well this evening, gentlemen. And how about this from Robert Pollock of Brooklyn? This is a question about heredity. I'm going to pose some questions about resemblances of children to their parents. Let us take the case of Mr. and Mrs. A. Mr. and Mrs. A are both blue-eyed, and they'd like a little variety in their home. That's what it says here. The phrasing is a little odd. They hope to have a brown-eyed baby. You see, they're both blue-eyed, and they hope to have a brown-eyed baby. Now, what are the probabilities of their hopes coming true? Mr. Huxley?
Well, none, unless they were one of the other of them was a candidate for Reno.
I see what you mean. Yeah. Almost immediately, should we say. Why would the chances...
You really don't mean Mr. and Mrs. A. My folks do.
Now, Mr. Huxley, why would the chances of having a brown-eyed baby resulting from 2 blue-eyed children be rather slim? Could you explain briefly to us?
Well, because the blue eye is what is called a recessive and the brown eye a dominant, and you can be brown-eyed and yet have blue in the background, so to speak, so that it can come out in the children.
Yes.
You can't with the blue.
Very good. All parents who are listening in, well, eyes that are blue and would like a brown-eyed baby, just out of luck. Now let us take the case of Mr. and Mrs. B, just to get away from your folks, Mr. Adams. Now, Mr. and Mrs. B are both brunettes. They're both brunettes, and they're very anxious to have a blonde-haired baby. What's the probability of their wishes coming true? Can anyone, Mr. Huxley, you help us out again?
Well, it's perfectly possible.
Yes, it is quite possible. Why?
Well, for the same reason, well, for the opposite reason that we had over the blue eye.
Ah, but I can't carry that in my head. No, I had that only 30 seconds ago. You want to rephrase it for us, Mr.
Because you can be a brunette and yet have the hereditary factor for blonde in your constitution. And if each of the parents had that factor, then one out of four children, on the whole, would be, on the average, would be blonde.
Well, that's fair enough. Very good, and I think very clear, Mr. Huxley. Now, how about another one? This is the sad case of Mr. and Mrs. C. Now, Mr. and Mrs. C. are both very short, and they've been pushed around most of their lives being very small people, and they're looking forward to having a big, strapping son. Now, I know the chances are Mr. Adams. Mr. Adams, what do you know about
it? The chances are not only tremendous, they happen.
You say that with some feeling.
I know it's so.
You know it's so? Yeah, so what, is very true. The answer that Mr. Adams gave is correct, but Mr. Huxley, you know as well as I do that Mr. Adams hasn't the slightest idea why. Mr. Kieran?
I don't think that size is inherited in the with the genes.
Mr. Huxley, can you help out?
Yes, it's inherited, but it's a good deal more complicated than the blue versus brown.
Yes.
Also, it's much more easily modified by diet and environment.
Yes, so that perhaps is the important point. The diet and environment might produce tall children, Miss Carter.
It's a matter of blue genes, is what comes down to.
Oh, come, come. Have you been mulling that over in that lovely little head of yours all evening?
Just thought of it.
Well, the point is that this possibility is perfectly reasonable that the short parents would have a very tall son. On the other hand, they might have a short one, too, or they might have a daughter. Or they might try and just not have anything at all. You can't tell. Now, here we have a question from Mrs. Paul Rowell of Fayette, Idaho. Get 2 out of 3 on this if you can. I want you to name the character in fiction, in literature, a character who seeks to plant evidence of guilt for his crime upon the following people. The character who seeks to plant evidence of guilt upon a weaver. Upon a weaver. Who is that? Any idea, Mr. Adams?
Is the weaver Bottom?
No. That throws you out of the game, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
All right. There's another weaver, not quite as well-known as Bottom. In Silas Marner by George Eliot, the character William Dane tries to plant the guilt of stealing some... the guilt on Silas Marner. Remember that? Who is a weaver and a miser? Well, now, name the character who seeks to plant evidence of guilt upon two grooms. Two grooms, Mr. Kieran.
Mr. Macbeth.
Yeah. No, I beg your pardon. That's not quite right.
Well, his wife did.
Yeah, Lady Macbeth. Well, we should make a distinction, I think. Lady Macbeth goes back after Macbeth.
Smears the faces of the posset drug groom.
Ah, well, you really know it, Mr. Kieran. I take it all back. It was just a little slip. Yes, Lady Macbeth does the smearing of the faces of the grooms, but the actual murder is done by Mac himself. Now, the character who seeks to apply evidence of guilt upon a village drunk. A drunk in our language, Mr. Huxley. What do you call them over there?
Drunks.
They're drunk. How about that? Don't know, gentlemen?
Van Winkle.
No, wrong, Mr. Adams. I'm awfully sorry. It's Injun Joe and Tom Sawyer who kills the young Dr. Robinson in the graveyard, and then he puts the bloody knife into Muff Potter's hand. Remember that? Does it come back to you at all? I think it should. Mr. Kieran,
yes.
Does come back to... Well, that's good. We're on a 2. That's enough. That sends us on to a question from Mrs. Milton Sen of Philadelphia. Name a specific ingredient which is responsible for the difference between these substances. Raisins and grapes. What makes the difference, Mr. Huxley?
Well, there's more sugar in the raisins.
I think not necessarily. I don't think that's what makes the distinctive difference, Mr. Adams.
A raisin is a grape that is dried.
So what ingredient, or lack of what ingredient, makes the difference?
Water.
Yes, I think water is a simple and correct answer. How about the difference between bread and toast? What's the ingredient that makes the difference? Mr. Kieran.
Heat.
No, the ingredient. Heat is certainly the condition. Yes, Mr. Huxley.
Water.
Some water is removed, but what more important change takes place when bread is converted into toast?
This,
Mr. Kieran?
Well, you have carbon formed there.
Yes, you do have a little burning, but what I was thinking of was that the starch is changed to dextrin. When I say what I was thinking, I mean I can read that off this card that I have here. It says the starch is changed to dextrin. I think I have to call that wrong. Now, how about cider and vinegar? What's the difference? What ingredient's responsible for the difference, Mr. Huxley?
Well, acetic acid versus alcohol.
Yes, acetic acid in vinegar is the thing that's added. I don't know if there's alcohol in cider in all of its forms, is there? I say that hopefully.
Yes, in all forms.
In all forms?
It really deserves the name of cider.
Ah, well, I guess some of it I've drunk doesn't deserve the name of cider, then. Here's one from Mrs. L.C. Upshaw of Laurel, Mississippi. Can you give the first and last words of a line of poetry? No, I'll give you the first and last words, and you give me the whole line. Get two out of three on this. Here's the first word, O, and the last word is enow. What's the whole line of poetry? Mr. Huxley. Mrs. Strother.
O wilderness were paradise enow.
Yes, very good. From the Rubaiyat. Here's the first word, when. The last word, spent. What's the line? Mr. Adams.
When I consider how my light is spent.
Very good, Mr. Adams. And what's the line from?
On Milton's blindness.
Yes, very Milton. Yes, very good, Mr. Adams. That's not an easy line to remember. And here, in this case, the first and last words are the same. The first is roll, and the last word is roll. Mr. Kieran?
Roll on, thou dark and deep blue ocean, roll.
How does it go from there on, remember?
Time writes no wrinkles on thine azure brow. That's part of it.
That's part of it, yes. 10,000 fleets sweep over thee in vain from Childe Harold by Byron. I guess that's all we have time for. And now Mr. Cross points out that besides the government stamp on every package of Lucky, there's another sort of stamp that's most important, if quite invisible.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the stamp of approval of independent tobacco experts. At auctions all over the South, these experts see just who buys what tobacco and the prices paid. And they show their approval of the tobacco sold American by their own overwhelming preference for Lucky's. In fact, sworn records show that among independent tobacco experts, auctioneers, buyers, and warehouse men, Lucky Strike has twice as many exclusive smokers as have all the other cigarettes combined. The reason's clear. These experts know that Lucky Strike means fine tobacco, because at market after market, year after year, they see us consistently pay the price to get the milder, better-tasting leaf. For example, at auctions in Franklin, Tennessee, season of 1939, we paid 24% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. At Conway, South Carolina, 35% more, and so on. And that crop, properly aged, mellowed, and blended with other fine crops, is in the Luckies you buy today. No wonder that with independent experts, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. Smokers, since you know that in a cigarette it's the tobacco that counts, isn't the stamp of the tobacco expert's approval definitely worth acting on?
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has paid out $250 defense bonds and 2 cents of the Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Strutter and Mr. Huxley, for lending your talents to Lucky Strike's party tonight. Now, next week, we'll have Mr. Kieran, Mr. Levant, Mr. Adams, and as our guest, the impeccable Adolphe Monjou, whose most recent screen vehicle you'll know to be Roxy Hart. Remember, for every question answered correctly, the sender gets $10 in defense stamps, and for every question that stumps our board, you get a total of a $50 defense bond, plus the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your letters with questions and the correct answers to Information Please at 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Hail, hail!